From Daylight, I'm Kazuki Akiba.
I'm Brandon Weiser.
And this is Sayonara Baseball. This is a podcast where you and I find unseen baseball gems by analyzing them alongside different trends, news, and motivation behind many moves around the league today.
On today's episode, we'll discuss the trade deadline and everything else that's happened in the past few weeks.
It. Center field, Brandon Nimmo back, 7-7, it's 7 consecutive games with a Joey Votto record.
Welcome everyone to a new episode of Sayonara Baseball. I'm Brandon Weiser. I'm here with Kazuki. Today is Sunday, August 8th, 2021. We are recording this episode at about 3 p.m. Eastern on Sunday while the Yankees and the Mariners are playing the final game of their four-game set in the Bronx. Therefore, we make no apologies if somehow we get an alert across our screens while we're recording this that the Yankees and the Mariners have a big moment. But first, let's all just say, I want to say thank you. Kazuki, I also want to say thank you to everyone for their patience while we waited for the trade deadline to occur, the Olympics to kind of unfold a little bit before we record another episode. But as I want to offer my personal thanks to Kazuki, who edited and mixed a rebroadcast of our episode with Skylar Brandt from March 2021. We decided to rebroadcast that with a new introduction that I recorded on the night after the women's all-around for gymnastics in the Olympics because of how the topics had aligned. So we encourage you to go back and listen to that when you have a chance. But now we'll get into the news of the past several weeks in baseball. We'll start off with a moment of tribute for an Astros legend who I frankly didn't know much about before he passed away, and I'm glad that I learned about him. Astros pitcher J.R. Richards passed away. What's notable about J.R. Richards after what I learned from after his passing on Thursday, August 5th, was in his 10-year career at the Astros, he pitched 76 complete games, had a record of 107-71, and a cumulative ERA just over 3. He held the team record for most strikeouts in a season until Gerrit Cole beat him in 2019. That record stood at 313 strikeouts in a single season in 1979. So for 40 years, he held the strikeout record for the team. Jose Cruz, the father of player Jose Cruz Jr. Jose Cruz was a member of several of the teams with J.R. Richards or the Astros. This is his quote. "He was one of the greatest Astros ever. When he was pitching, we knew that we were going to get a W." I'm not sure how many times I've heard that from a player about a pitcher in all of baseball. He goes on to say, I didn't get too many balls hit to me in the outfield when he pitched because he was so dominating. And we think about dominating pitchers. And I watched a couple of clips of J.R. Richards pitch in the All-Star game in 1980. And he was mowing people down. And that was incredible. And unfortunately, 1980 was also the year in which J.R. Richards suffered a stroke while in practice with the Astros a couple weeks after the All-Star game, which effectively ended his baseball career. He found some hard times afterwards. He came back, revitalized life, and unfortunately passed away recently. But J.R. Richards is just an incredible story when you think about like what the Astros were in that era and what they are now, the dominating pitchers. For him to be that revered is just a great story to recall. And to the news, we start with Team USA in the Olympics. Team USA, both softball and baseball, took home silver medals. They lost close games in the gold medal round to Japan. We'll have more on that later. But it was really interesting to watch Team USA softball basically mow everyone down left and right and get to the game against Japan and just lose at the very end. Team USA baseball was in the loser's bracket, came back, got in, and they played Japan and just couldn't get the win in the end. Before I get into that, the Scott Kazmir as the first base coach slash being their star pitcher was just a great look, but we'll get more to that later. And then we have what we call the injury report, brought to you by Everyone's Getting Hurt. Fernando Tatis Jr. on a slide on Friday, July 30th, took a nice shot to the shoulder, and he was in pain. And according to sources at ESPN, season-ending surgery is a possibility, though we currently don't know exactly what's going to happen there. Tyler Glasnow will miss the last bit of the 2021 season and presumably most of the 2022 season, as Tommy John surgery has been proposed to remedy his ongoing UCL issue, which, as according to MLB's Adam Berry, was related, according to Glasnow, to the new way he had to throw a ball after the new initiatives about foreign substances on the baseball. So there's that complex. We'll see how that goes. Jacob deGrom has experienced a setback in his rehabilitation progress. He'll be shut down for a couple more weeks, expected to come back at the end of September for the Mets, according to Newsday's Anthony Reber and Tim Heel. And the Mets are right now in the thick of it for the NL East. I believe as of last night, they were in third place. I mean, the new local news here just bouncing up and down between the Braves, the Mets, and the Phillies. Who's going to take first at this point? We have suspension news. Ramon Laureano of the Athletics and Hector Santiago were both suspended 80 games for failing PED tests, effectively ending their 2021 seasons. Hector Santiago can't catch a break. It's his own undoing. Ramon Laureano, definitely his absence will hurt the Athletics. So we'll see what happens there.
It really helps that they got Starling Marte.
Marte is like the saving grace. We're talking about saving graces when it comes to the trade deadline, but Starling Marte definitely has been a saving grace for the Athletics. Now they have a true center fielder without Ramon Laureano. August, the month of August now, we'll have some notable TV broadcasts. Tonight will be the first Sunday Night Baseball game on ABC in many, many, many years. Though it's there for kind of a somewhat obvious reason. Due to the Pro Football Hall of Fame's enshrinement ceremony being on two nights this year, ESPN has to broadcast that on ESPN. So they couldn't and they cannot broadcast Sunday Night Baseball on ESPN2. So they have to put it on ABC. So that's basically what happened. We'll see how that goes. That's an interesting game. It was Dylan Cease versus Zach Davies. We'll see how that plans out because that's an interesting series to watch. Two teams in very different aspects after the trade deadline. On Thursday, August 12th, Chicago and New York will play in the Field of Dreams game in Dyersville, Illinois, which is exciting. They released the uniforms, which everyone says looks exactly like the movie, except the Nike swoosh needs to go away. According to Tommy Birch of the Des Moines Register, the field will have the ability to have an attendance about to 8,000 attendees. I'm not sure exactly how they sold tickets. I heard it was a lottery of some sort. And of course, the field is set amongst the cornfield. It's beautiful. If you look from an aerial photo, it literally looks like the Field of Dreams type photo. I believe the set where they film Field of Dreams is not far away either. So that's pretty cool. And probably about the time where our next episode is recorded, we'll have the MLB Little League Classic if that goes off, which will be the Angels against the Indians, which means all goes according to plan. Shohei Ohtani will play, maybe even pitch, in front of a group of Little Leaguers from around the world, which I don't know how I would feel when I'm 11 or 12 years old watching that, but it must be pretty awesome. Just think that you could have Shohei Ohtani right in front of you in a very small environment. That'd be pretty cool. With that, the news has concluded, we think, for now. And then we'll go into our regular segments. For the cycle today, of course, we're going to start with the trade deadline. Lots happened. Every single team was involved at least one trade leading up to the trade deadline. We have an update from Oakland, sort of. They had the vote. We'll not see how the vote really offered. Kumar Rocker is a free agent already. We'll explain that. Cleveland got a new nickname for 2022, so we'll go through that. We'll tip our caps. We'll give them the hooks. And then we'll talk about our walk-up songs of the show. And this is the Anna Kendrick edition. I've been watching Pitch Perfect over the last couple of weeks. I caught a little snippet of it. So I was inspired to bring back a couple of songs that she helped me introduce to me. Extra innings, we'll talk about the Olympics, both softball and baseball. And for our walk-off segment, Kazuki visited a new baseball stadium recently. So we'll get his take on that. And with that, we will start with the big, big event of the last several weeks. As the trade deadline, as mentioned, every single team was involved, at least one trade leading up to it at some point. 10 total All-Stars were dealt, according to David Adler, Matt Kelly, Sarah Langs, and Andrew Simon. It is 21 facts about the trade deadline in 2021. Those were traded were Gallo, Cruz, Gibson, Frazier, Escobar, Schwarzer, Scherzer, Bryant, Kimbrel, and Turner. And if you're wondering why that sounds kind of strange to hear a lot of players from the same team, yes, the Cubs traded a lot of players. So I'm going to read off the Cubs players, and then I want to hear something, some thoughts from Kazuki. The Javi Baez went to the Mets. Craig Kimbrel went to the White Sox. Rizzo went to the Yankees. Bryant went to the Giants. Chafin went to the Athletics. And Tapera also went to the White Sox. That is a lot of players to unload from your team. And now the Cubs are basically minor leaguers or bench players or some degree of combination of players they got. So what do you think about the Cubs going full rebuild on July 30th?
I mean, I think that was the best time for them. They had a bunch of expiring contracts and they had that 11-game losing streak. So there was no way for them to keep contending at this point and might as well get as many pieces they can. And they got many great like prospects that could be loaded up in their farm system. So it's a matter of just playing the young guys to see how they develop. But I think it's going to be a rough time for all you fans in Wrigley right now. It's going to take a couple more years for them to be fully in contender mode right now. But I think because they've been mediocre for the past few years, it was just the right time for them to do all of this.
Yeah, they really sent out the farm on everybody. I will say the most interesting one, I think, was the Baez trade. I think he was going to get traded. I think they were going to get rid of most of their infield, and they got rid of most of their infield. Andrew Chafin to the Athletics is an interesting one, just because the Athletics are just, they will always add pitching. And then Craig Kimbrel going across town. And we'll see how that goes. I mean, prior to the show, you mentioned that that back of that bullpen is scary. I mean, yeah, you're going to face Craig Kimbrel and then Liam Hendricks. And I had Craig Kimbrel go to the Red Sox, which have been an equally as more dominating back end of the bullpen with Barnes and him. But that's definitely a top
notch. But they paid a huge, huge price getting Kimbrel. Like, they give away their future second baseman and Nick Madrigal to the Cubs. I know he's injured for the rest of the year, but he was their future, second baseman, and that's a hefty price for a rental reliever.
Yeah, I guess the White Sox really thought there's no one else competing against them this year. Honestly, they probably felt like this is our one shot to truly just dominate the playoffs, get the playoffs, and go for it. So we'll see how that goes. The other team that really did a lot of trading was the Nationals. They traded Turner, Scherzer, Schwarber, and Harrison to the Dodgers, Red Sox, and Athletics. The Josh Harrison trade, I think, is just strange just to get rid of him. But, I mean, why not? Trey Turner and Max Scherzer to the Dodgers. The Dodgers are just loaded up now. And Kyle Schwarber to the Red Sox, I didn't really get. I don't really get that trade because the Red Sox have a really not a great offensive efficiency numbers, according to a lot of reports.
Especially at first base, and now you're making Kyle Schwarber learn first base.
Right. And I thought they were all in on Rizzo, and they didn't go anything on Rizzo, and they went for Schwarber. There's that. The Nationals, I know, are just going to bottom out this year, which is what they kind of expected to do anyway. We'll see. But as we kind of alluded to, the Dodgers sent prospects to everybody, get everyone they wanted, between Turner, Scherzer, and then Danny Duffy from the Royals. Danny Duffy's currently injured, but they sent prospects to everybody. And it's amazing how the Dodgers can just send prospects to everybody. Like they have so many players. You can do whatever you want. And the fact of the matter is, like, they add all these players, and like their Cy Young candidate is still Walker Buehler, which is just great. Walker Buehler is barely 23, 24, I think, and he's by far their best pitcher this year. Even Clayton Kershaw is looking up to him with many statistics. The NL West is just mad. I mean, you got Adam Frazier, who went to the Padres. Talk about that infield just being loaded. I mean, Tatis is now injured, but I say you can put Ha-Seong Kim in and you can bat like a good defensive. He's not obviously not the most power hitter, but he's a good defensive player. But that infield is fantastic. Go to the Dodgers. The Dodgers have everybody under the sun. And then the Giants made one big trade and it just kind of shored up everything else that they had. So the NL West is definitely loaded. But I will argue that the most interesting division now in the National League is actually the East. And that's predominantly because of what the Braves and the Phillies did. The Braves added bits and pieces of four total outfielders to basically combine to replace what was Ronald Acuña Jr.'s performance this year? Soler, Duvall, Rosario, and Peterson. And I'm going to go with that was really genius, particularly getting Jorge Soler, just because he's a great player for what he stands for. They got Duvall, I think, for basically nothing. Jock Peterson was not great for the Cubs, and he comes over here and is playing pretty decently, and they got Rosario. So they get all these little pieces, which is great. I think they kind of shored up their one true gap.
And also their bullpen was Richard Rodriguez.
Right. So they got Rodriguez from the Pirates. So they basically just added, they had a high level and they just kept building on that. And they really didn't give up a lot. But they got, I say, minor pieces to supplement a superstar. The Mariners puzzled everybody. And not just because Suki and I are being Mariners fans. The Mariners puzzled everybody. And we're going to jump the Mariners real quick before we go head back to the NL East. When the Mariners traded Kendall Graveman to the Astros, while they were facing the Astros for Abreu, they traded Graveman and Montero for Joe Smith and Abraham Toro. And everyone in Seattle was just, what are you doing? You're trading away your best reliever for who? And Toro, who hasn't played a whole lot. Now Toro's been playing and playing actually pretty well. But they ended up then flipping pieces and getting Diego Castillo from the Rays. And I think, as many Seattle reporters have basically illuminated, the reason why they gave up Graveman was actually pretty sound. Graveman was going to be a free agent, and they would get no recompense for him whatsoever. And he was going to probably demand a pretty good chunk of money, being on his performance this year. So what do? You trade him. You get a decent player in Toro, and you get Joe Smith, who's been around the baseball forever and can be a clubhouse guy, which is great. You kind of need that.
And you also get rid of Montero, too.
Right, and Montero was a waste after his performance. But with getting Castillo, you get control. Castillo has more years on his contract. And Castillo, once he kind of builds himself up a little, he's not been pitching so well for the Mariners since he got there. That's really what I see as kind of the gain here. And Toro is a great fill-in because now the Mariners face this very interesting dilemma. What do you do with Kyle Seager's contract at the end of the year? You have brought up the point that they could probably take that money, split it, and get two pieces, but they would have paid him for one contract. We'll see. I don't know. But that brings me to the final discussion point. Really, who was the winners and the losers of the trade deadline? I know your loser is safe for one of our later segments. I'm going to go with the winner is very clear to me. And that's the Philadelphia Phillies. The Phillies traded silently, like very silently, went to Texas. Like, can we have Kyle Gibson, Ian Kennedy? And I was like, okay, here's a couple players, your whole prospects. I'll go. And they got the Rangers' best pitcher and the Rangers' best reliever. And now the Phillies are at the top of the NL East that quickly. They were pretty close, but now they're playing quite well. They're playing the Mets right now. I think that was genius. I think it was utterly just so smart to get those two players. Because you and I had Kyle Gibson as basically the number one target for pitching, other than Matt Scherzer. So that's the other thing. I'd say the next one was for the Blue Jays to go get Berrios. And that was a smart mix of
but also very, very hefty price.
Right.
Austin Martin is going to be a superstar. Like, that's hefty.
Right. I think Berrios definitely, but Berrios fills that problem that we always talk about the Blue Jays. They have couple great pitchers, and there's a cliff. And you kind of bridge that cliff. You made that cliff a little bit smaller now. I will say everyone goes back to the Willy Adames trade as like this really smart trade. And I think that was basically Tampa Bay being Tampa Bay. But the Brewers benefit from it greatly because he's been playing quite well for them. The Dodgers, though. The Dodgers traded their future. And I don't know if it was really worth it because they were really good. But they have to trade everybody to get Scherzer, Turner, Duffy, and everyone else?
I mean, yeah, they debuted Josiah Gray, their number one pitching prospect, and Kiber Ruiz. I mean, I get the Kiber Ruiz number two prospect because he's blocked essentially by Will Smith and Austin Barnes, and Will Smith has been playing another level this year, so it makes sense to move him. But Josiah Gray, when pitching is always, like, you know, very limited, like, that was kind of puzzling, but yet I think I understood the move. Like, they needed someone to replace Trevor Bauer, and they got the man, Max Scherzer. And I think it's also the fact that Padres was close to getting Max Scherzer, so they wanted to take him away from their division rival so that they're loaded and San Diego cannot, you know, get Scherzer. So it's like the big brother complex of making sure Padres doesn't get anyone.
And I think that, you know, once they moved for Adam Frazier, that was definitely the strike fear into the division a little bit. Now it's interesting. You look at all the divisions. Like, I think the AL Central is done. I think the NL Central is pretty much done. Like, you kind of know what's going to happen. The AL West is a little more up for grabs than I expected. Mariners less so after the performance of the Yankees so far this past series. But
they've always been kind of bad against the Yankees. If they could get, right now it's 0-0, but if they could get at least one win, I think that's a win for them despite losing the series.
I think the A's definitely have a shot now to take it over the Astros. Like, they're really just going to
put... Are you sure about that? Astros are very good. That's without Bregman right now.
Oh, that's right.
And they have back into their bullpen solidified. It was Yimi Garcia, Kendall Graveman, obviously, and you have Ryan Pressly, and they picked up two more pieces. Like, they've basically revamped that bullpen, and they're like, you know, lineup has been a star killer. Like, you have Altuve hitting a career year again. You have Kyle Tucker developing into a great prospect, everyday guy.
You brought up earlier the Starling Marte trade, and I think that if Starling Marte revisits his old self of Pirates lore, I think they have a shot of really putting a little bit of a pressure on the Astros to kind of you have to really outperform. I think the A's may be poised to get that wild card then easy.
I think the wild card spot's pretty pressured. If we look at it, AL East is kind of reshaping itself, because we always talked about it being the Red Sox and Tampa Bay's division, but now Blue Jays is a big contender. Yankees, you know, Gallo and Rizzo did like revamp that whole dynamic. I'm not sure about Heaney as much, but I still don't think they'll like reclaim their glory into the playoff contention. But like, I think they're kind of contending for that wild card spot right now.
The National League, I think if we go to the AL, we kind of know what's going to happen. It's either the wild cards that come from the East or the West. Basically, it's either the A's, some combination of Red Sox, Yankees, Blue Jays, whatever those are. The NL, you got three teams vying in the East and three teams vying in the West. The Giants obviously are a surprise of everybody. I don't get that. But the Giants have 70 wins now, so we'll see what happens. I think it's the Giants division in the West. And then for the East, I'm pegging the Phillies. For some reason, I think the Phillies definitely have something special going on right now. And the thing, like, Andrew McCutchen is like the lead. Obviously, he's a great leader in the clubhouse, but he's definitely performing quite well. And then you have a bunch of pieces that have kind of some come together. And then I think, like you said, getting two pitchers just alleviated a lot of pressure on all the other pitchers in their entire assortment of pitching, both starting in the bullpen.
Yeah, I agree, because you had your three-headed monster and Nola, Wheeler, and Eflin, and by adding Kyle Gibson, who's essentially your number two or three starter, that kind of alleviates the pressure on the top three guys so that they don't have to always be like shutting down the lineup like day after night. But the biggest part was Ian Kennedy, who's been a great closer this whole season. Now, like, you know, Neris, Suarez, and Alvarado, who has not performed well in the closer role, could now do whatever they need to do, a fireman role, or even Archie Bradley. They don't have to focus on closing the game because you already have a shutdown reliever there.
Archie Bradley, it's a name that I always can come back to, because when he's on, he's great.
Yeah.
He's been that way since he was a Diamondbacks player.
But the point, like you mentioned, it added a lot of flexibility to that whole bullpen, that they don't have to be the guy who has to take the ninth. They just need to focus on their inning, whether it's seventh or eighth inning, and then, you know, you have Kennedy, game over. Like, you don't have to worry about anything else.
The Mets, I'm curious to see what happens when they have like their full assortment of players really back from being healthy. Getting Baez, I think, just adds like a bat that you probably didn't really need, but can just, when you get Lindor healthy and everyone just come back and hitting home runs like crazy, I mean, it's gonna be just liftoff. It's gonna be, everyone's gonna be going nuts. The Braves, I wish they've added a little more pitching. Rodriguez is great, they filled the gap with Acuna being hurt. But now it's, can everyone keep up with each other? Same thing out west. I mean, you have the Padres being without Tatis is bad, but Ha-Sung Kim can fill in. And you got Frazier to add to that infield.
And you could shift Cronenworth anywhere, and then right. Hosmer could play still, first base.
You remember this. You still have Jake Cronenworth. You didn't give him up, which is just amazing. Because you think about, like, I have to get ready somebody. Get Jake Cronenworth. Dodgers, everybody. We could skip over that.
I mean, the fact that they have Trey Turner now is just it's just crazy, right? And he's a second baseman, and Corey Seager is already back. Like, the question is, who are they going to fill in their lineup every night? And Cody Bellinger has been the worst player this year for them, which is saying something.
So surprising.
I know.
So surprising. The other one that really strikes me kind of curiously is with the Giants. Because all they basically did was get Chris Bryant. Their pitching is solid. Their hitters are a bunch of like older veteran players who are playing quite well. And a bunch of players we probably never would have heard of unless they were playing for the Giants playing quite well. Like, I think of Darren Ruff. Like, he just comes up to bat and like you just see these bombs going everywhere. But also he goes in the field, he's playing quite well. And they got everyone else. Chris Bryant just adds to that level of play.
And the fact that they don't have everyone healthy, right? Like Crawford or Longoria. So like once Longoria comes back, you know, Chris Bryant won't be playing third base. He's in the outfield.
Oh, yeah. You can still do that. You can still do that. Huh. That's quite interesting. You can just keep putting him out there. So we'll see how that all goes with the trade deadline. And now we'll get to a quick little bit on what's happened in Oakland. So the vote happened in Oakland July 20th. The Oakland City Council actually approved the measure. But they approved the term sheet that they created originally with some adjustments from the Athletics, but it wasn't what the Athletics had proposed as the latest addition. So according to Darwin Bongram of the Oakland Side website, the city council will not enter a deal that will use tax dollars from the city's general fund to pay for infrastructure upgrades around the waterfront project. The Athletics wanted that. There's part contention number one. Additionally, city council favored a plan that demanded the Athletics dedicate at least 15% of new housing built for the project be allotted for affordable housing opportunities. That's also a point of contention. And finally, any deal will have to ensure that there are no loss of jobs at the Port of Oakland. Another point of contention between that and the proposed terms from the Athletics. Major League Baseball came out with a pretty strong statement that was not too kind. For the last 4 years, at my request, according to Commissioner Manfred, and urging, the Athletics have invested significant resources and have made a major commitment to their community in the hopes of remaining as Oakland's only major professional sports franchise. Manfred said in a statement, "We are disappointed the City Council chose to vote on a proposal to which the A's had not agreed. We will immediately begin conversation with the A's to chart a path forward for the club." Dave Cavill, president of the team, also stated that a vote on the city's terms would be a no on the project, according to Bill Shaken of the Los Angeles Times. And then July 30th, Annie Siaka of the East Bay Times and Mercury News, two local papers in the Oakland and San Jose area, reported that the City Council and Oakland Athletics have returned to the negotiating table. And again, the point of contention is this funding for all these things, because who's going to pay for what? And this goes back to our whole discussion we had about new stadiums. Who's paying for what? Is it coming from the city's funds? Is it coming from private funds? So we'll see how this goes. But there is now, I would essentially, two paths to success. You can either take the waterfront project, or you're going to be heading off to Las Vegas is the number one candidate. Those, I've heard Vancouver, British Columbia, is a new contender in the clubhouse. And then they go back to Nashville and a couple of cities in the Midwest. The other one that comes up every time is San Antonio. But I'm not really sure what's going to happen with San Antonio, because they've had these off and on negotiations with everybody for teams. We will read local news to keep you updated on this. But if you can, I encourage you to read the Chronicle. If you subscribe to the Chronicle, it's a little bit easier. East Bay Times, Mercury News, Oakland Side website, source that we've kind of brought up. The LA Times has done a good outside perspective from California, also reviewing it. And the Las Vegas Review Journal from Vegas, their reporters. Everyone has different perspectives. So I encourage you all to kind of get all their perspectives. But that's kind of the quick update on that. Got a lot more years to figure this out, but it seems like we did not move much further, but there's now truly two paths of success here. Now, we'll move into a more puzzling story of the last couple of weeks. And that's the story of Kumar Rocker getting drafted and not being signed by the Mets at the 10th overall pick. According to ESPN's Jeff Passan and their reporter Kylie McDaniel, who covers prospects, New York Mets and Kumar Rocker did not come to agreement on a contract before the deadline of August 1st. Therefore, the slot that he would have had this year has been moved as a compensatory pick to the Mets for 2022. So they get the 11th overall pick in 2022, regardless of how well they perform this year, which, great, I think. Rocker is now available to sign with any independent team in the United States or nationally. He can also return to Vanderbilt and pitch one more season with Vanderbilt. However, this is a nuance of the collective argument that I was quite intrigued to read about. He cannot join another team until after the 2022 draft. So he can't sign with like the Rockies or any other team that needs wants pitching right now. He has to wait a year and then can re-sign. That's according to CBS Sports' RJ Anderson. During the period from the time he was drafted until the time that he decided not to sign, all these reports came about with his shoulder and his arm and his health. So we all knew that his velocity dropped in his last couple years at Vanderbilt. So we'll see if that was really what they were talking about. But there was no clean look at his MRI, according to what the Mets said. And then we get to the quote from Steve Cohen, who is a hedge fund manager by trade, just happens to own a baseball team now. His tweet kind of set off a lot of interesting red alerts from people, and people were not taking to it too kindly. He goes, education time. Baseball draft picks are worth up to five times their slot value to clubs. I never shy away from investments that can make me that type of return. Then why didn't you? Rocker seemed like a sure thing being drafted at 10, and now he's not? It's just kind of like a puzzling. And if you had doubts about him originally, I think, and then you pick him up at 10, is it like a play to get the 11th pick next year? Like, I don't understand exactly what happened there. But the conflict is just interesting. So we'll see what happens with Kumar Rocker. I don't think he'll go to Korea or Japan or anything like that so quickly. Though he might.
Yeah, I think what's so interesting is Mets had like a bunch of marketing billboards of Kumar Rocker saying that he's coming to town, but yet they cheapened out on their negotiation to get Rocker because they got scared of the health records.
Everyone got scared of the drop in velocity and how that related to something else.
Yeah, and there might be like an underlying like injury, but on the Scott Boras's camp, his agent said like, you know, according to his, you know, health experts, like, you know, he's healthy and fine. So we're getting a lot of conflicting opinions.
Yeah, it's definitely something that I am quite puzzled by. So we'll see how that goes. The last bit of news is an interesting one, and we'll revisit it shortly thereafter. But Cleveland is not going to be the Indian next year. They are going to be the Guardians on July 23rd, right on the heels of the Olympics starting. So it's like kind of like buried in the news cycle. They announced they'll become the Guardians next year, according to Mandy Bell, who's a great reporter for MLB.com and based in Cleveland. The nickname Guardians comes from the Guardians of Traffic, a series of sculptures that line the Hope Memorial Bridge, which I have seen. It's actually very cool in near Progressive Field. So there's a bridge. Progressive Field is right on the edge of downtown Cleveland before you get into this like giant group of bridges that cross over to this other part of Cleveland. This one bridge has these beautiful sculptures on it. And they're all different modes of transportation that have influenced everyday life for the past 100 years. And they were designed when this bridge was created. And there's towering sculptures. And I like the nickname. I like the nickname Guardian. I'm going to be very candid with you. It comes to the And I'll read what Brian Barron, the president of baseball operations, said. He goes, "We think Guardian is unique and authentic to Cleveland." I agree, Brian Barron. It's less about the Guardians of Traffic and more about the Guardians represent the idea of protection. For us in our research, Cleveland folks are very protective of one another. They're protective of our city. They're protective of the land. Cleveland, this is for you. We think of LeBron James with that quote when they won the championship. That's one key component, the resiliency of people here in Cleveland and Northeast Ohio, and the loyalty to Cleveland, loyalty to each other as teammates, coworkers. We all feel like Guardian really starts to evoke from an emotional standpoint, which is great. However, the other one that people were going back to was the Spiders, which was the original team name. And I learned this actually from our friend Todd, when they were first founded years and years and years and years and years ago, was the Cleveland Spiders. I would think that'd be kind of cool to bring them back. When this originally came about a couple of years ago, a Cleveland reporter brought up the idea of like Rockers, which was the WNBA team when WNBA was founded, which is a great name, great logo, blue and silver, black, blue and silver guitars with their logo. I think it was so cool. Unfortunately, that team folded. That'd be an interesting team to bring back. And then the other team in Cleveland is the Lake Erie Monsters, which is their minor league hockey team in the American Hockey League, the AHL, which is the AAA of hockey. So they have some great ideas to kind of play around with. And Guardians kind of fits the bill for being local, so to speak. However, the team has kind of run into a problem. And with that, I'll leave that as like a tease. Coming up after the break, we'll discuss Eric Haas and Joey Votto and all that they've done in the last couple of weeks.
Breaking news here on CBS Sports HQ as the MLB trade deadline approaches and the deal that we have been waiting for as the deadline closes in has occurred. Third baseman Chris Bryant from the Chicago Cubs has been dealt to the Giants. It was a deal that we'd been talking about.
Welcome back, everyone. And we're going to continue with our regular segments. We're going to go with our tip of the caps, and then we'll go into our hooks, our songs, and a couple extra things at the bottom. Tip of the caps this week, so the players that we thought performed quite well, Huskell Weeks, month of July. I'll start Eric Haas, the Detroit Tigers. Detroit Tigers are not good. Record-wise, they don't look good. We talked about Akil Badu being in the season, but overall, they're not great. However, in the month of July, AL Rookie of the Month was a Detroit Tiger, Eric Haas, who just stepped in and performed amazingly well. Like I said, AL Rookie of the Month, according to Evan Petzl, Detroit Free Press. These were the stats for Eric Haas in the month of July. He batted .265 with 9 homers and 29 RBIs in a total of 23 games. 3 doubles, 6 walks, 26 strikeouts is a little bit off for me. Had a 945 OPS, which is quite good. On July 27th, he had a game-tying grand slam that sparked the team's 6-5 comeback over division rival the Twins. And as of the end of July, he led the team with home runs, which is just great for a team that, like I said, as if you've been following us throughout the season, we talk about like teams that are not good will spoil teams that are good. And we're seeing that right now. The Tigers just completely threw the Red Sox for a loop. And having a person in your clubhouse like Eric Haas is definitely a reason why you can do that. Because if you think about like the Diamondbacks in the NL, like they have a couple of players that will just throw you off. They'll not make you play the top of your game. Like the Diamondbacks are the thorn in the side of the Giants, I think, recently. But if you think about the Tigers can throw off basically the White Sox and every AL East team. Just every AL East team, because I think more AL East teams are going to play them recently. But basically, that's what's going to happen. The Tigers are certainly going to be the spoilers of many good stories this year. And Eric Haas to be performing that well this late in the season as a rookie, I think is very, very important for that team to kind of as they build to next year and going forward. You stuck in the Midwest with me, traveled down to Cincinnati, and Joey Votto.
Yeah.
What's going on, Joey Votto?
Joey Votto of the Cincinnati Reds is my pick. I joked around and said, if you watched a show Loki on Disney Plus, we were asking if this is a Votto variant. Like, is this the real Votto? Because we have not seen Votto like this in such a long time. So we think he's from a completely different timeline. Jokes aside, he was named NL Player of the Week for the week of August 1st, which was last week. And he posted this slash line right here. 375 was a 448 OBP and a 1.25 OPS. So he had 8 runs scored.
That's a big OPS for him.
It is. 8 runs scored, 9 hits, and 7 home runs, and 11 RBIs, 4 walks over 6 games played. And he recorded a club record for 7 consecutive games homering from July 24th to the 30th, totaling around 9 round trips during that torrid stretch. So he became the 8th player in Major League history to homer in 7 straight games, first since Kendrys Morales of former the Mariner. Blue Jays and, yep, former Mariner, Angels, you name it. in August 2018. In addition, he came within a foot of homering in an MLB record tying eighth straight game after hitting a ball off the orange padding at the right field wall in the eighth inning at Citi Field on that Saturday. So he delivered eight straight hits as home runs, tied for the second longest streak since 1961, trailed Mark McGwire of the Cardinals back in the days, who had 11 straight games of home runs in 2001 for the all-time record, according to the Elias Sports Bureau. And he became the second player in baseball history to notch at least 9 home runs, 15 RBIs, and 6 walks across 7-game span, joining McGwire of 1998. That is a feat.
That is a lot for him to go for. And I will say with the Reds, like I said earlier that the Brewers are basically the class in NL Central. The Reds are not too far behind to really shake that things up a little bit. And Joey Votto, Nick Castellanos, Jesse Winker, all that collection of players, if they all perform at a high, high level, those division games toward the end of the season are going to be just tougher than you would imagine. Because
I agree. And the fact that they actually addressed their problem, which was their bullpen, and over the deadline, they got Luis Sessa and Justin Walsham from the Yankees. And they added Michael Givens from the Rockies. Like, that solidified their bullpen quite a bit.
There you go. And they don't have to put so much pressure on Amir Garrett now. That team, when they are fully playing on all cylinders all year long, are a lot better than I expected. And I think that even goes back when they got Moustakas, like years ago, a couple years ago, and they built everyone through. It's just like they have started building a good franchise there. So we'll see how that kind of unloads. But it's just an interesting group of people. Like, thank you for sharing that. And I'll stick in Ohio for my not-so-great segment, give them the hook. And as I mentioned earlier before the break, the Cleveland Indians have a problem. The Cleveland Guardians, they already exist. The ClevelandGuardians.com is a website for a roller derby club, which is competitive. It's a competitive sport. It's very popular in the Midwest in particular, but ClevelandGuardians.com is owned by a men's roller derby club. And according to Sportico's Michael McCann and Cleveland 19 News' Avery Williams, we now are in like this weird trademark battle. Indians filed a trademark on the day of July 23rd for the Guardians. The Guardians Roller Derby Club filed an application on July 27th. However, first come, first serve doesn't work like that, and we'll explain that now. In a strange twist of events, both sources mentioned that the Indians filed an application for the trademark in Mauritius, which is a small island nation east of Africa in the Indian Ocean, on April 8th, according to trademark attorney Josh Gerben, to establish priority to beat out any trademark poachers. Because we see this all the time with like website domains. Like, people will buy up website domains to kind of do this. According to McCann of Sportico, this move may not work because the U.S. Patent Trademark Office generally applies a standard called first to use, not first to file. The Cleveland Guardians Roller Derby Club has existed for many years compared to this trademark application. So what does this all mean? Sportico sought out an expert for this, and they went to Professor Alexandra Roberts, a trademark law expert, University of New Hampshire's Franklin Pierce School of Law. Her opinions have been a lot throughout the news, various trademark things, but she came back with this opinion on this one. The possible confusion of having a team with an existing nickname being taken by a new team is a very troubling issue, especially when they're in the same industry as sports entertainment. And I'll go to a very simple example of what happened when I lived in Vermont. There was a restaurant that had the same name as another chain Italian restaurant throughout the country, but they didn't have a location in Vermont. So what happened is that restaurant got sued, got a cease and desist, and had to change their name. But people in Vermont still called it the old name. However, their signs, everything in their ads and their newspaper said the new name. Also in Vermont was another kind of interesting dilemma with trademark thing. And this one's a little more out there, but the same kind of issue happened. If you are a frequent patron of Chick-fil-A, they have Eat More Chicken. Eat More Chicken is very much a Chick-fil-A thing. There was a gentleman in Vermont who tried to like boost like farm to table culture and boost like shopping local. He did Eat More Kale. Chick-fil-A sued him for trademark infringement because Eat More Kale sounds too similar to Eat More Chicken. The federal judge who looked at this case years ago laughed and literally said, these sound nothing alike. Kale and chicken are two different food groups. There is no Chick-fil-A restaurant in the state of Vermont. This has no weight and no bearing. So if you see like the differences along the trademark thing, like I'm not a trademark expert. These are the only examples I can think of. The restaurant example in Vermont is just like this one. They are very parallel. You have two things that are exactly the same industry and exactly the same name, and they will exist somewhat similarly. The restaurant they were comparing to existed within 100 miles of the location in Burlington, Vermont. Chick-fil-A doesn't have a location that close, nor does it have like any standing. It's a fast restaurant. It doesn't have that kind of standing. So we'll see how this all goes. The legal scramble is on right now because by 2022, they're going to have a new nickname. So they have the Guardians. Will they pay the Roller Derby Club an enormous sum of money to take their trademark or their name and then accept the trademark? We don't know. But maybe during the off season, we'll figure this out more as we approach like collective bargaining agreement, the winter meetings. We'll probably have more information. But right now, it's not a sure thing we're up to Cleveland Guardians next year, which is kind of an interesting thing. We'll go back to the Spiders. But with that, we go to another front office, Rocky Mountain front office, Colorado Rockies, and they're in action.
Yes. My give them a hook for this week is the Colorado Rockies, the front office, especially. They had a great opportunity to really move their premier star players and other pieces for more prospects and replenish their farm system. And they did absolutely nothing. They did not move their star players, Trevor Story, or even their star pitcher, John Kray, at the deadline when both of their contracts expired at the end of the season. And their record's not that pretty. They're 44-59 as we speak. And according to Fangraph, they have 0% chance of reaching the postseason. And they entered this deadline day very hardline stance, and they did not give up anything despite having John Gray or even giving up a 36-year-old reliever and Danny O'Bard. Great story, but like he's not going to be in your contention window, so why not give him up? And the best the Rockies can now do is to give Story a qualifying offer at the end of the year and hope for a draft pick compensation when he declines, which I think he will. That is a horrible strategy. Like, they should have been like the Nationals and the Cubs and traded all these pieces so they could get more players. It's better than getting a draft pick. Like, that's like you get two or three more pieces over just one, like maybe good or maybe not good pieces, because prospects are not a sure thing. So they're giving my hook. I think that was a poor decision on them. And I don't know what can I say about the Rockies. They're just bad.
The Rockies are bad. Diamondbacks are bad in that division. But I think the Rockies front office is just looking. That inaction was puzzling because we all had Trevor Story being the easiest player person to trade, and he didn't get moved at all. Like you said, they gave away one pitcher to the Reds, but that's a minor trade compared to unloading a John Gray or Trevor Story, Daniel Bard too. I don't know what they're going to do. That was basically free players if they got rid of him. And now he was not happy. I read a couple reports where he will go next year. I don't know, but I think now maybe this gave Story a little more power than he thought, because he could end up with a new team than, let's say, the Yankees or the Red Sox, something like that. We'll see. Maybe he'll end up with the Mariners. That's a long shot though. Comparatively,
well, I think the
interesting one would be like the Marlins or something, like some like strange team in the NL, like other team in the NL, because like the Marlins have like tons of open space. The Brewers may pick him up for goodness sakes, and just add players like that. But I think it gives him a lot more freedom to choose teams, and basically the couple that he originally had. Maybe that's,
you know, he could also have a 1-year deal with some other club, and you know, prove it deal, and then, you know, the club pays $20 million for 1 year. And then if he does well, then he'll get a long-term contract.
That's something the Rangers would do, honestly, down in Texas, because they have so many good young players. And you just add a player, compete a little bit, and then we'll see what happens. But with that, we'll end the give them the hooks, and we'll go to our walk-up songs. Like I said, I mentioned earlier, these are inspired by Anna Kendrick. They are both not songs you should listen to if there are children in the room. So explicit language, parental advisory. Is noted. The first song's a little bit clearer than the next one. But the first song, if you are a fan of the movie Pitch Perfect, you know what song I'm going to, and it's not Cups. It is No Diggity by Blackstreet from the Pitch Perfect movie in the riff off scene in the pool as her and many of the new freshmen are joining the Bardin Bellas. I will leave it there, but we have that this amazing scene. And so the group Blackstreet in the song. Blackstreet was founded in 1993 by Chauncey Black Hannibal and Teddy Street Riley. No Diggity was released on July 29th, so almost 25 years ago, 1996. It features artists such as Dr. Dre, who has been around the game for years, same with Queen Penn. The song, I did not know this, knocked off the Macarena from the top spot in the Billboard Hot 100 of all the songs to knock off. And the Macarena had been there for 14 weeks. Well, I think the Macarena is the number one one-hit wonder of all time in American music history. The song won the 1998 Grammy Award for Best R&B Performance by a Duo or Group with Vocals. The song is ranked number 32 in VH1's Greatest Songs of the 90s. In terms of the song's dynamics, the hook is just chef's kiss spectacular. The instrumental track is probably one of my all-time favorites. I even got to hear this song covered by a funk band at a wedding, and it was absolutely phenomenal. No doubt. No doubt about it. Like I said, the song is played in the movie with Kendrick's character, Becca, joining the rest of the Bardin Bellas at a pool for a riff off as part of the initiation into the acapella groups on campus. When the time comes, Kendrick jumps in and starts in on the verse, and the rest is simply acca magical. So we'll have that as the first one. And then many years later, Anna Kendrick came back with another great musical performance. This one from the movie A Simple Favor. And this song is called Anti Up by M.O.P., which, if you're from New York, is a quintessential New York hip-hop R&B rap song. I mean, it is just, it's got a lot of language in it, but it is just really good. M.O.P. was formed in 1992 by Billy Dance and Lil Fame in New York City, a city that gets a lot of references in this particular song. Anti Up was released off their fourth studio album, Warriors, in September 9th of 2000. The song charted as high as number 7 in the U.K. A remix was released at the time, also with Busta Rhymes, Teflon, and Remy Martin. Besides being featured in A Simple Favor, where Kendrick raps one of the verses while driving in a car. I mean, she also did it on Ellen afterwards, and it's just great to watch her just literally going on the verse and just keep going. The song's been featured in numerous TV shows. It has a great setup. So we have Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Superstore, and The Mindy Project have all featured this song. The song is just New York hip-hop at its finest for that day, that era. If it was a little bit cleaner, I presume you could hear all the time at a Yankees or a Mets game. It just has a little too much of language that you probably couldn't play publicly unless you clean it up a little bit. But it's such a good song. And we'll keep adding those to our playlist on Spotify for the year. Now, to the extra inning segments. As I mentioned earlier, Olympic baseball came back in 2020 Tokyo as an event-based sport, which means the host nation proposed bringing it back as a representation of sports that are popular in their country, which meant teams could compete for it. And we saw some pretty stellar things. First off, U.S. softball is real good. Team Canada softball, really good. I got to see them come back. Team Japan softball, come back, really good. Same with Australia. So those four teams in particular. For Team USA, I got to see two players that I loved watching when we were in college. Kat Osterman, Monica Abbott. Olympics returned for baseball, mostly with players either out of the MLB or playing internationally. I don't think any MLB players were allowed to be a part of the team.
Yeah, because usually World Baseball Classic, most of the ownership will not allow players to play in this competition because they want to win, you know, the championship in their own league, then sending them out to a national competition.
Correct. And that means we saw this got Kazmir with the flow hair and just looking just
real yeah, and good. Todd Father was playing third base.
Tyler Austin was playing.
Yeah, because he plays in Japan right now at the NPB. As I think he's a player for Yokohama Bay Stars in Japan.
Right. So you have a lot of players from Japan and Korea that are playing in
minor leagues.
Jose Bautista played for Dominican Republic, which is great to see him play.
And Mariners prospect Eric Failia playing for Team USA.
That was good. So the minor leaguers were allowed to go out, which is pretty nice.
Oh, and our own Julio Rodriguez represented Dominican Republic.
That's right. there was a couple other pitchers that I saw that looked familiar. Masahiro Tanaka was on the Team Japan, and they played at Yokohama Stadium, which has famously a bullpen cart, which was great to watch. People get really excited about that. But now the question is, will it return in Paris, in LA, in 2024 and 2028, respectively?
Paris, no, because they announced that it's going to be breakdancing that's going to be taking over baseball and softball. But LA, yes, they're bringing it back.
Right.
I think because the breakdancing, that
artistic sport is extremely popular in Europe. It would dwarf anything in the US comparatively, I think. But I think that's great that they get their own sport, like Japan got their sport. But I think, right, you're right. I think if they can bring up baseball and softball in the US, in LA, barring any situations, you can have fans at Dodger Stadium, Angel Stadium, maybe Petco Park. I'm not sure they're going to play. But to play games there would be kind of cool. Softball too. I'm not sure they'll play softball. They played softball and baseball in the same stadium. They played it at Yokohama in both games. They just changed the field dimensions. Can you imagine playing competitive Olympic softball in Dodger Stadium?
I could see that. And I know Dodgers in the past played in the football stadium, the Coliseum, the USC Coliseum. They played baseball there against the Red Sox before. So that's a possibility too.
So I think that'd be really cool to play softball. I think the idea of playing softball and baseball in the same stadium was kind of interesting. You put the fences around. The landscape looked a little different, but that'd be kind of great. And I can't imagine what it would be like to put on a Team USA jersey or a Team Dominican Republic jersey or a Team Japan jersey, Team Australia jersey, and to stand on that field playing baseball or softball. It would be just so cool. And they might play at UCLA too. I think about that too right now. The question is, what will they return? We'll see how that goes. And we'll end on this. Kazuki got to see the Mariners play the Tampa Bay Rays at Tropicana Field, which is by far voted most often the worst stadium in baseball. And what'd you think?
I have to agree with most of the consensus here. It is one of the worst stadiums I've been in. I'll say some positive first before digging into the negatives. There's some cool features about Tropicana Field. I think one part is there's like a lights that flows during the seventh inning stretch, that I wish they used that more as an actual game time lights. Like, why can't they have an orange light over the dome the entire time so that you don't have an ugly fluorescent light in the baseball stadium that won't blind everyone's eyes? So it looks like they're simulating sunlight. You know, that would have been a cool thing. And the fact that, you know, it rains a lot in Tampa, so it's nice to hear rain in a dome environment. That's a nice sound. Let's see. Other than that, you know, I got to sit in a very nice seat for cheap. I was right by the Mariners visitors dugout when we watched the game. Yusei Kikuchi pitched the game, and so that was kind of cool to see. I think in most stadiums, there'll be like a corporate America seat, so it'll be at least like $1,000 or $2,000 easily sitting nearby. So what can I say from there? Otherwise, there's some decent bar section by the outfield, and there's also the Stingray tank. I think that's kind of fun to play around. Otherwise, I think the fans are great. I think the fans are pretty respectful. If you go to any other big stadiums like Yankees or Fenway Park, there's some fans who are not respectful and they could be kind of trashy, but at least the Rays fans are very respectful, even if you're cheering for the other team, and they're very knowledgeable and acknowledge, like, you know, who's good and who's bad. For instance, they thought Abraham Toro is great. So, you know, they have a lot of knowledgeable fans. To the bad stuff, I think the reason why the stadium is so bad is it doesn't feel like a baseball stadium. It honestly feels like you're entering like a gymnasium, you know, in high school where you're just trying to do some physical education activities. Like, that's what it kind of felt like going in. So it felt very mundane and boring. And the worst part was, you know, not many great food. It just, you know, you have Papa John's and some fried chicken and fries, but like, it's not like where each ballpark has like their own unique local restaurants. Like T-Mobile Park, for instance, they have Din Tai Fung, one of my favorite Taiwanese food out there. And they have all of those together. And they even have some special features, like you could eat a grasshopper there, you know? I think that's what's kind of lacking. It's a little bit overpriced food. I think the problem with Tampa, the reason why they don't have fans as much, is the fact that it's really hard to get into St. Pete. there's only two ways to get into C&P, which is through the tollway of 275 from the 75, or you have to kind of go around the 75 and go south entering the St. Pete. So St. Pete is kind of like its own island that's kind of hard to drive into, and it takes a lot of time to do it. And then the parking situation is really tough. Luckily, we were able to research and find like a really cheap parking lot that was a little bit east of, you know, the stadium. And I got to like pay only $2 for like 5 hours that I stayed there. Well, if you go to Tampa Bay's like stadium parking, it's probably $15 or $20. So some tips right there. So a little bit of an overpriced feeling there. So otherwise, St. Pete is not a bad city. It's just, you know, you wish it's accessible and it's not. So I think that's just my overall thought of the actual environment of getting into the stadium and just being at the stadium. It's just not that great of an environment to be in.
I think you're describing most of like the facilities nature as to why people didn't like the Kingdom after a while. The Kingdom kind of just looked and felt old. It's a great ballpark. But it just looked and felt old. And I think that's kind of where the Tampa Bay is kind of standing. It's like, it looks and feels old. It's not in Tampa, it's in St. Pete. And it's a difference compared to, let's say, the Buccaneers and Lightning play in Tampa Bay. We'll see how it really unfolds with that. Like, people always say they're potentially going to move in that sense. So, We'll keep an eye out for that. I just heard my beep on my screen, so I apologize if that comes off the audio, but we'll see. The last thing there is, you mentioned something that I'm really curious about, and that's the food. I think about the same as that really I quite enjoyed. In Pittsburgh, they have all these local restaurants, have shops, on that they call it the Plaza, and they do that. Baltimore has that. City Field has that. Quite well, actually, I will say that. And the new one, even the old Met Stadium had it too. Fenway Park does. I don't remember Nationals Park quite well from when I went there. But I also am probably, I'm not sure if you remember, the outside of the Trop. Anything there or not really?
There's a lot of bars and a couple like apartment complex. There's not really much of a restaurant per se where you could go after the game and eat. It's just a lot of hookah bars. And
that was an interesting thing that they're building up in a lot of the newer ballparks. So I'll go with Nationals Park, PNC in Pittsburgh. I even see it when I look at a map of Minnesota. But the interesting thing is, like, you compare this to like another interesting ballpark, like Chicago's, both of Chicago's. Wrigleyville is an mecca in its own right. And then you have Comiskey, USCellular, Guaranteed Rate Field, which is in like Southside, which is a whole different environment compared to those two environments. And then you go like to something that's completely out of completely different, which is like Globe Life in Texas, which is literally in the middle of nowhere. Like, there is Arlington is kind of its own little like island. I think that's kind of like the whole idea of what they're comparing St. Pete against. It's like St. Pete's, it's not like Arlington is not Dallas. St. Pete is not Tampa. I was like, what do you do with the two of them? So we'll see how that unfolds, because we all know they're threatening move any chance they get it, they get. And with that, everyone, we will conclude today's August 8th episode of Sayonara Baseball, and we will see you again quite soon.
That's it for this episode of Sayonara Baseball. This episode of Sayonara Baseball is hosted and produced by me, Kazuki Akiba, and Brandon Beiser. This episode was edited by Kazuki Akiba with additional research by Brandon Beiser. Our theme song is by K. Margus. Sayonara Baseball is a production of Daylight and Media 3 Limited. We'll be back with another episode. If you like this podcast, please rate, review, and subscribe to our podcast as more people will know about this show. Go to daylightinteractive.com to see some exclusive updates and more about our upcoming shows. I'm Kazuki Akiba.
And I'm Brandon Beiser.
And this has been Sayonara Baseball.